BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to This Cultural Life, the series in which some of the world's leading creative people discuss the most important influences and experiences that inspired their own work. I'm John Wilson, and my guest in this episode is the film editor Thelma Schoonmaker, who, for over five decades now, has been Martin Scorsese's cutting room collaborator. Having edited his very first feature film in 1967, she's worked on every Scorsese movie since Raging Bull, including Goodfellas, Casino, The Departed, Wolf of Wall Street, right up to his most recent features, The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon. As the widow of the legendary British filmmaker Michael Powell, Thelma has played a key role in the restoration of classic Powell and Pressburger films, including The Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, and A Matter of Life and Death. Thelma Schoonmaker has won three Academy Awards, more than any other film editor. Thelma Schoonmaker, welcome to This Cultural Life.
Thank you.
You were born in 1940 in Algeria, where your father was working for an American oil company, and then you were evacuated as a family to the Caribbean island of Aruba at the fall of France in 1940, that same year. Your earliest memories then, I presume, are Caribbean.
They are, yes. I wish I had known something about Algeria. My mother loved it. She never wanted to leave, but, you know, the North African invasion was going on, so they took us out.
What sort of cultural upbringing did you have as a child?
Well, my parents met in Paris. They were both American. Well, my mother was there from the time she was a teenager. My father came over to work for American Express, and so they both spoke French, and they both loved Europe. So I had a wonderful world upbringing from my parents always. And then on the island of Aruba, they brought people in from all over the world, Czechoslovakia, Australia, France, Germany. So I was around people who were different from Americans right from the beginning, and I loved that. And when we came back to the United States when I was 15, I was very disappointed to lose that. And everybody seemed a bit homogeneous to me, so I wanted to go back to that world, and that's why I decided to become a diplomat, if I could.
Oh, that was the idea, was it? Because you had this global perspective from being a young girl.
I missed it. I really missed it.
But that cultural melting pot you're describing on Aruba, that could be New York as well, surely, in the 1950s.
Not as intense, because I wasn't living in New York. I was living in New Jersey.
Right.
So I hadn't experienced the great, incredible artistic richness of New York yet. So I was very unhappy. I said to my mother, I don't know about being here in America. So my decision was to become a diplomat if I could. I studied Russian language and political science at Cornell University, which was a wonderful place. Vladimir Nabokov was there, and I got to audition some of his wonderful lectures about literature.
Wow.
And so I thought, well, I'll go take the State Department exams after I graduated from Cornell. I passed all the exams, but then they gave me a stress test because they sensed I was a bit liberal, you know, and they said, well, we're not sure you're going to be happy here. So what would you do if you were in South Africa at a cocktail reception and somebody said, what do you think about apartheid? And I said, well, I would say that's terrible. It has to stop. And they said, well, you can't do that until the government tells you as a diplomat that they've made up their mind to take that stand. And they said, you're going to be very unhappy here. So I left and didn't become a diplomat.
But has that training, that background in diplomacy held you in good stead when it came to the cutting room?
Definitely, because, you know, my director, Martin Scorsese, is such a complex and fascinating character. So you always have to go with the mood of what he's in at a certain period of time. It's the best possible job in the world, but diplomacy does come in to play, for sure.
When did your interest in movies start? Did you see them at the cinema or on television initially?
Well, I saw Red Shoes when I was 12 on the island of Aruba, which is amazing that they brought that film there.
The Powell and Pressburger
film. It was a worldwide hit. It was so impactful, I remember it vividly.
I thought once, Mr. Lermontov, that there would be no room in my life for anything but dancing.
You will think so again, my dear.
My mother wouldn't let us watch television. She would choose what we watched at night, and she worked and came home after I came from school. So when I was 15, I turned on Million Dollar Movie, and there was The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, what I consider the greatest Powell Pressburger film ever made. And I was just stunned by it, and I was able to get all the way through it before my mother came home and put her hand on the TV set to see it. But I never thought I would get involved in film, but I was just so impacted by those two movies. And
we'll talk more about Powell and Pressburger later on in this interview. But what was your introduction to film editing then, initially?
It was all a big accident, because I got a job with a Peace Corps program at Columbia University. There was a professor training people to go to Sierra Leone. And then that ended, and I saw an ad in the New York Times, which never happens, willing to train assistant film editor. And I don't know, I just sort of thought, maybe I should look into that. And I did, and it was a terrible man who was butchering the great films of Europe for late-night television slots. So he would just take a reel out of a great film by Visconti.
He was shortening them for the time slots.
He was shortening them, and he was making a decision. I mean, that was even I knew that was bad. So I stayed just long enough, and I couldn't take it anymore. But I did learn how to cut negative, because we were chopping things out of these great movies, unfortunately. I quit the job because I couldn't stand what he was doing. I saw there was a 6 weeks course at New York University in filmmaking. I could just afford that.
What led you to a filmmaking or film editing course in the first place?
You know, I really don't know, because I just think that those two movies I had seen were had such an effect on me, and I just liked the idea of it. It was very different from what I had studied, and I really don't know why this act of fate. I mean, what luck that I should meet Martin Scorsese at this place.
On This Cultural Life, Thelma Schoonmaker, I asked my guests about their formative influences and experiences, those things that have inspired their own creativity. And inevitably, we're going to be talking about Martin Scorsese. You have edited, I think, 22 of his feature films now. So where did it start? When did you first meet?
Well, it was all a big accident, fortunately for me. I had seen this course advertised for 6 weeks at New York University to learn a 10-minute film, how to make film a bit, you know, just the beginning. And the professor at the end of it said, someone has miscut the negative of Mr. Scorsese's film, and is there anyone here who can help him put it back together? And I said, well, I have a little experience with cutting negative, so I'll try. And I went over, and there was Marty. He had been sitting up for 3 days editing his movie, and he was completely zonked, but it would do anything to get his movie back. So,
and he was a student. He was on the same course?
He was one of the students in the 6 weeks course, but he was actually studying film. That was what his degree was going to be in. So this was almost his last year there. So I said, well, listen, I'll try and help you. And he says that during 36 hours, we put back together what had happened to his film. I don't remember it being 36 hours, but that's what he said. And I think because of that, he felt he could trust me to do what was right for his films if he needed an assistant or an editor. And so he took a gamble on me to work on some things with him. We were making little documentaries for television and with other people from New York University. And so gradually things developed, and I worked on his first feature film called Who's That Knocking, which most people haven't seen. But he was teaching me about editing. I knew nothing about editing, nothing. And so he gradually was teaching me as I was helping him with Who's That Knocking. That was such a lucky break.
This was 1967. I think it was the starring Harvey Keitel in his...
That's right.
In his debut, and in effect, your feature film debut.
Oh, yes.
You really have me believing that.
I do love you. That's why.
What? That's why? Because you love me, that's why you're not going to marry me? What kind of business are you handing me here?
And that was a great experience. I mean, because we were all doing everything, holding microphones, pushing wheelchairs as for crane shots, doing the slates. It was a wonderful group of fantastic people working together happily to help Marty finish his film.
Hey, 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 the beat is getting stronger.
In 1969, you and Martin Scorsese both worked as part of the editing team on the documentary film Woodstock, about that huge music festival that had happened just earlier that year. You were Oscar-nominated for your role as an editor. What did you, in particular, bring to
You know
bring
what happened was, while we were making these documentaries, we were lucky enough to get this beautiful German machine, which was a flatbed machine, as opposed to the old Moviola, which was very noisy and upright. We could have three picture heads, or we could take the picture heads out and put sound heads in. It was incredibly flexible, beautifully designed machine. So the crew that we've been working with went to film an Aretha Franklin concert. And when we got the dailies back, I was cutting it. We noticed that when there were three images of her or two, she seemed dynamized. So we thought, why don't we do a movie like this? And Woodstock opportunity came along, and with great bravery, Michael Wadley, the director, decided to go for broke and spend his own money to get us all up at Woodstock, and that was just an amazing experience.
Well, the sense of excitement and the scale of that festival is heightened by the use of those superimposition of images and those freeze frames. You see it, you know, I remember seeing The Who, and as Pete Townsend leaps into the air, he's frozen in that moment.
You know, it was absolutely wild. We went up thinking, we rented motel rooms. We thought that we would drive back there after the evening performances. We couldn't even get out. It was jammed with traffic and people coming. So for 3 days, we never had a place to sleep. We slept on the ground, ticks in our hair, no food. Every once in a while, someone would come up with a Frankfurter, maybe, if you were lucky. So it was an amazing ordeal, but also tremendously exciting to have six cameramen on the stage. The main cameraman was Michael Wadley, who was bent over an Eclair camera looking down at a lens for 3 days solid, with no sleep, no food, doing these amazing shots of people like The Who. Scorsese was helping Wadley decide what numbers to shoot, and there were people backstage negotiating for rights to do it, and sometimes they would kick us off the stage. The Who actually kicked us off the stage. But then they didn't even notice because they were so having such a great performance that we snuck back on. I was mainly underneath the stage trying to load magazines. We had six cameramen on the stage, 15 out in the audience. We had no idea what we were getting, you know. I mean, we were hoping and praying it was okay because we couldn't send the film out to be developed. So it was this mammoth, absolutely back-breaking job, but so exciting. And when we got back to New York, we realized we had something very special.
I knew you were working on that film after as supervising the cuts. And then the Oscar nomination, of course, for that film. I had no idea you were actually there underneath the stage as the bands were playing.
I know, and it was, you know, we'd brought friends up. There were pregnant women. People brought their dogs. It was insane. And it was raining a lot.
Yeah.
And so the cameras were jamming. And so they would throw the, you know, the magazine under the stage and we would try and reload it. And it was madness. I mean, I've never gone through such a horror. It was like being in a war. The great moment was the last day. It was dawn. We had been shooting all night again. We were completely exhausted.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
And Jimi Hendrix came out. And I thought, my God, is this really Jimi Hendrix or am I dreaming? And he did that incredible job of playing the Star Spangled Banner and massacring it to show what was happening in Vietnam. It was a transformative moment. And then suddenly it was over and everybody had left. There was just mud and detritus everywhere. We packed up and barely were able to do that. And then on the way home, we stopped and ate for the first time. And Michael Wadley was so tired that his head just crashed into his spaghetti. And when I got home, I had big welts on my pants because we've been wearing the same thing for 3 days. You know, Marty thought we were going to be able to go out to dinner, and he had brought cufflinks. And, of course, we were just trapped in there with everybody else.
In a muddy field for 3 days.
Yeah.
But the sense of excitement, the visceral thrill of that documentary is so overwhelming. And maybe that is explained now to me because of the fact that you were there. So when you were editing, you knew how it felt.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that helped?
Definitely. And, of course, we hadn't seen all the footage we had of the people who were out in the field.
Mm.
And we got wonderful interviews. There were so many wonderful things in that we didn't even know we had. However, Warner Brothers were not interested in the film. They said, it's a news event, just get it out quickly. And we said, no, you don't understand. We have something very special here, a breakthrough in how to film festivals and how to film music. So it took actually a work of thievery to prevent them from cutting the movie, finally. We were supposed to bring the movie to New York City to show the press.
Mm.
And Warner Brothers was saying to us, you have to cut it down. And we said, no. So Dale Bell, who was one of the producers, and I went in and stole the soundtracks from the vaults.
Wow.
To keep them from cutting it. So they had no choice but to send the version that we wanted to New York. And they had Pinkerton guards on me. I wasn't allowed to go in the projection booth because they knew that we had stolen the tracks. So
that was radical intervention.
At one point, I was standing watching the press look at the movie, and they were getting up and dancing in the aisles, which I've never seen before. So we knew we had something special. But Ted Ashley, the head of Warner Brothers, came up and touched me on the shoulder, and I jumped. And he said, okay, you're right. We won't cut it.
I'm fascinated by what you said about seeing those rushes when you arrive back to start editing and seeing all of that, those images of the kids arriving and the interviews, which make that film so special. But does that say something about, there's that saying, isn't there, about you find the movie in the cutting room very often? Is that what happened with Woodstock?
With documentaries, that is what you do. You're given a lump of stuff and you have to make it work like a movie. You have to find a shape and speed and movement. So that was not unusual. We had done a lot of documentary filmmaking, which is very important to the work that Scorsese and I do together, because that documentary history has really affected his work a lot.
The following year that film was released, 1970, and you were nominated for an Oscar for Best Editing. Looking down your CV, you didn't then do another feature film until 1980 with Martin Scorsese, of course. That was Raging Bull. What happened for a decade?
Yes, well, unfortunately, Scorsese went to bust in Hollywood and did, and he wanted me to work with him. But the union at that point in L.A. had very old-fashioned and very illegal rules. You couldn't edit unless you had spent 5 years as an apprentice, 7 years as an assistant, and then you could edit. And I said, I was just nominated for an Oscar, so I'm not going to spend 5 years as an apprentice. So I couldn't work with him. I mean, it was absolutely not allowed. So I worked on other documentaries and things until he came back to New York.
Mm.
And our producer, Irwin Winkler, somehow got me into the union.
And the winner is Thelma Schoonmaker for Raging Bull.
Raging Bull won you the first of your 3 Academy Awards. It must have felt like a huge vindication for you personally after having that battle with the unions and being almost ostracized from the industry for decades.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, it was, first of all, my first big major feature film, you know, on a Hollywood lot, which I had never done before. I'd never been in California before. And I'd always used to put my own trims away. And now I had 3 assistants and a backup editor, and I was just not used to this. They were shooting the fight sequences for Raging Bull for 6 weeks. And Marty and De Niro would come to see the dailies every day of the previous day. And that was quite an experience because it was such a powerful film. I could see right away. I couldn't take my eyes off De Niro. Marty had thought that film out so incredibly. The fight sequences are amazing. He determined that he wanted to be in the ring, which is very hard when you have 2 fighters and a referee and a film crew. And he somehow did it.
That's his documentary training, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. And brilliant conception of the shots. So I was still learning in terms of feature film editing. I had been editing documentaries before while I couldn't work for him in Hollywood. There couldn't have been a better film to learn on than Raging Bull.
Well, ahead on point. He hooks a left to the jaw, left and a right to the head by Robinson. Lamotte.
Raging Bull tells the story of the boxer Jake LaMotta, played by Robert De Niro, and it's a film that spans three decades. It's about the rise and fall of this boxing legend. It's a beautiful film. It's a very brutal film as well. What were the main challenges for you in the cutting room, do you think?
Partially it was the structure, because Paul Schrader had written the script, and he wanted to do a flashback to De Niro heavy as an older nightclub entrepreneur. After every fight. And Scorsese and I went to screen the film. We always screen it by ourselves the first time. And we both said, my God, that film is so powerful, even in the first cut. And the projectionist opened the window to his projection booth, and he said, that's some movie, which was really amazing. But we felt that we should take out the flashbacks and only see Jake LaMotta fat at the end. Mm. That was the biggest decision. But basically, it was a matter of making the fights as brilliant as they can be, but also what Scorsese and Michael Powell, who we'll talk about later, are so good at is making you care for people who are not perfect, who are not villains or heroes, who are complicated people. And that was what was very important in terms of shaping De Niro's performance. In fact, at the very end, when he confronts himself in a mirror, Marty and De Niro did 15 takes. We never do that, because they were talking to each other in between.
I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
And just in terms of the process, some people might think that the film editor joins the production after everything is wrapped. But from what you're describing there, you're on set all the time.
I'm not on set, but I'm in the editing room.
But, I mean, as it's being made.
Definitely. I'm on from the first day of shooting. Always have been.
And cutting dailies, or
yes,
are you waiting
yes.
for everything to
well,
be finished?
Well, what will happen is that Scorsese will screen with me, even if we're in different locations. For example, on Killers of the Flower Moon, I couldn't go to Oklahoma because of COVID. So Marty and I would do it on the Zoom. So the most important thing for me as an editor is to sit with Marty and watch what he feels when he sees his dailies for the first time. Mm. And you should never forget how you feel about those dailies the first time. That impact is very important to hold on to. So he tells me what he thinks. I tell him what I think. He'll say, I hate that take. Don't show that to me again. I liked a part of this take. And then from that, I start building the movie in what we called an assembly, which is a loose composite of it in proper script order. And then he comes into the editing room and edits it with me after he's through shooting. And that's very important. It's completely a partnership, a collaboration between the two of us. Editing is his favorite thing in the world. So,
in most of the pictures I made, we kind of nail it on the set, usually. And invariably, looking at rushes, I'll tell Thelma that's the take. And then she'll feel a certain thing for some other takes, and we line it up that way. Ultimately, what I think I need her to watch for me is the emotional impact of the picture, is keeping track emotionally of the characters. This is the key for me.
There is a long history of women in the film editing business. I think somebody called Anne Bouchens, who was nominated in the film editing category in 1934. And in fact, she became the first woman to win a film editing Oscar
yes.
6 years later. Without being too simplistic about this, do you think, is there something about a female sensibility that you bring to the editing process and to the aesthetic of a film?
I think there is. I think from my own experience, there are times when I have noticed something more emotional in one take than the other, which I think comes from being a woman. I really do. And I keep telling people, you know, I was not one of the first film editors. There have been women from the very beginning, famous women, actually.
And in terms of the influences, the aspects that determine the way a film is edited, you sent us a note, in fact, before we met today, to talk about the use of music in The Last Temptation of Christ. Mm. Music composed by Peter Gabriel, which you said deeply affected you in the editing process. Just tell us something about that music and what Gabriel was doing.
Yes, Scorsese's decision to ask Peter Gabriel to do the score was quite, you know, surprising, but fantastic, because Peter committed himself so deeply to the film that he started recording the music even while we were still editing. And we kept saying to him, no, wait, because this is only a first edit. There will be four or five or six edits. Wait, no. He wanted to do it immediately as soon as he started seeing footage. So he had a studio below where our editing room was, and Marty and I would go down to watch him record with all these amazing musicians from around the world. But the greatest moment for me was when Peter Gabriel decided to use a famous Pakistani qawwali singer, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, one of the great musicians who ever lived, as the music over Jesus carrying the cross to Calvary. It was, I just have never seen anything like it. It had such an impact. And I think the solo voice, too, was something about the suffering that Jesus is going through. It was a stunning moment, but all the whole score is stunning.
Scorsese was shooting Last Temptation of Christ in Morocco. You weren't there with him.
Yes.
Were you?
No, I wasn't.
No, so how was he getting those dailies back to you then?
The dailies had to be sent to me in New York and developed, and then I had to report to Marty. At one point, he shot the crucifixion, and that was a very difficult day. There were wild dogs running around the set, and poor Willem Dafoe could only be up on the cross for 5 minutes, because what happens when you're up on the cross is you suffocate to death. It was a hellish day, and the light was going too soon, and Marty only had one day to do it, and it was agony. So when he phoned me on a radio phone, that was the only thing way you could talk to him from Morocco, and asked me about the crucifixion, was it okay? And I started to cry because it was so moving. And poor Marty saying, what's the matter? Is it no good? Do I have to reshoot it? I can't reshoot it. What's the? So I'll call you tomorrow. So he called me tomorrow and I started to cry again. But eventually I reassured him it was okay.
And the negatives were being flown across from Morocco to New York?
And sometimes when they opened there would be sand, you know.
Scorsese obviously is a huge rock and roll fan. He really loves that 50s and 60s and early 70s rock and roll. We hear it in so many of his soundtracks. How does it determine the rhythm of the edit? It's getting
near dawn. Sometimes what'll happen is he knows already that he's going to use something. For example, the Mascagna music, which is the theme for Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull. In the very beginning, you see him bouncing in a ring. He knew that from his childhood. He used to hear that piece of music through the windows of the tenement, and he decided to use it. But there are times, for example, on Casino, where my editing room would be filled with charts of 9 different pieces for each scene that he was thinking of. And we would play them all, and then one would click, you know. He loves to compose his own movies with his own musical knowledge, and my job is to help him make it work possibly the best.
That's really interesting that you're saying you're almost auditioning the pieces of music and then setting them to the cut. Does it ever work the other way around when he is determined to use a particular piece of music and then it changes the edit that you're presenting?
Yes. Well, I mean, as soon as you put music to the image, then you immediately find there are things that would work better if you tightened this or if you moved this shot around. There was one time when Scorsese wanted to do it with the beautiful piece, Layla, in Goodfellas, when De Niro is killing all the people who made the heist with him. Marty wanted to show all the dead bodies, you know, one in a garbage truck, one frozen to death in a truck, a meat truck. He had Layla running on the soundstage, and he was making sure that the shots he had designed for certain bars were fitting properly. And then me, as an editor, I had to make sure they did fit properly.
When you won your Oscar in 1980, you were up there on the podium and you immediately thanked and credited Martin Scorsese, and you said it is a team effort, it's a joint effort, a collaboration. Is it possible to imagine how different his films may have been if you hadn't have worked with him?
Oh, it's not for me to say. But I'm just so happy that he trusts me and feels comfortable with me. He had had some bad experiences in Hollywood with editors who didn't understand his use of rock and roll or improvisation, which was groundbreaking at the time. And he was very glad to get back with me on Raging Bull because he knew I would be with him all the way and understand what he was trying to do and help him do it.
Your next choice for this cultural life, Thelma, is Michael Powell, who, of course, with Emmerich Pressburger, his partner, made some of the greatest British films of all time, Matter of Life and Death, The Red Shoes, and many more. Michael Powell was also your husband. We'll talk about that in a moment. But what was it about the Powell and Pressburger films that appealed to you so much when you first saw them as a child?
The powerful emotion in them, not sentimentality, by the way. When I saw The Red Shoes, it was so different. It was so powerful. It was so emotional. And the subject being that you can devote yourself to art, even if it's dangerous, was something I guess I was absorbing at the age of 12. I don't know. But it certainly never left my mind.
And how would you characterize their filmmaking style?
They were very brave, very unusual. They created movies from original stories, not from books. And they wanted to challenge the audience. One of the things that Michael Powell taught both Marty and me is never explain. Make the audience feel what you're trying to get across to them, but don't tell them how to think. That's a real sin. And stay ahead of your audience because they're ahead of you. So you try and stay ahead of your audience. And Michael Powell suffered deeply from this desire to be ahead of his audience when Peeping Tom was made. But he always said, if you're ahead of your time, you're out on a limb, no one's going to help you, and you can be cut off easily, which happened to him. But I would rather be ahead of my time than conventional.
The reputation of Powell and Pressburger had waned in the 1960s with the advent in Britain of the kitchen sink dramas, Carol Rice, Tony Richardson, Lindsay Anderson, and all of those sort of filmmakers coming to the fore. To what extent did Martin Scorsese resurrect their reputation?
Well, it was devastating for Powell and Pressburger. Not so bad for Pressburger because he was writing scripts for other people too. But for Michael, it was absolutely devastating. I think one of the triumphs of his life is that he never gave up and he never became bitter. And he asked me to put on his gravestone, Michael Powell, film director and optimist. And he was. And living with him was heaven because he enjoyed every moment of every day. Or made something of it. I had the 10 happiest years of my life with him as a result. What was happening was that Scorsese and Ian Christie here in England and Kevin Goff Yates at the British Film Institute realized that they should try and bring these films back. Mm. And Marty was desperate to find them because he was so impressed by their work. He came to the Edinburgh Film Festival to get an award for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and they asked him, who do you want to give you the award? And he said, Michael Powell. And they said, who is that? They had no idea who these great filmmakers were. So Marty came to London after Edinburgh, and he met Michael Kaplan, who was doing publicity for 2001 for Kubrick. And Kaplan said, I know where Michael Powell is. And he arranged a lunch for the two of them. And Marty was so thrilled. And Michael was stunned that this young director knew everything he'd ever made and was asking him, how did you do that shot and why did you do that? And he writes in his autobiography, the blood started to run in my veins again. That'll show you how terrible the period of oblivion was. He was almost taken to jail for not paying the rates on his property. A friend did that so that he didn't have to go to jail. He couldn't heat the house he was living in, and he got big chilblains on his cheeks as a result.
That's absolutely shocking, isn't it? Somebody who'd made such incredible films that had such influence and longevity.
Genius films. I mean, maybe some of the best films ever made in England, but they were thrown on the trash heap.
Received your message. We can hear you. Are you wounded? Repeat, are you wounded? Are you bailing out?
What's your name?
June.
Yes, June, I'm bailing out. I'm bailing out, but there's a catch. I've got no parachute.
You were married to Michael Powell in 1984. When did you first meet him?
Well, Scorsese, from the first time I ever met him, we would go to the movie theaters and watch, you know, the greatest film from Kurosawa in Japan or, you know, the great French films of the New Wave. Once we started getting videos, then Marty would send me home with one of the Powell Pressburger films because he wanted me to learn them and fall in love with them the way he did. That was my great education. And when Marty had arranged for the Museum of Modern Art to do a retrospective on Powell and Pressburger, he brought Michael over and Emmerich. And he came for dinner one night at Marty's apartment where we were editing Raging Bull. And Marty said, would you like to meet him? And I said, oh, yes, of course. So there he was, this amazing man with his love of art all over his face. Didn't say too much, but when he said something, it was really important. And he came back to where I was editing, and he saw film racks in the bathtub. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever seen, because we were editing in an apartment. And then I started seeing him when we went out for the Oscar nominations to Hollywood. And then, surprisingly, things developed between us, luckily for me.
Michael was there a lot, pretty much became part of the family, really. My mother and father would be cooking dinners, he'd be there. Robert De Niro, Keitel, Brian De Palma, whatever social event, Michael would be there. And I guess met Thelma that way, got married in 84.
Yeah. That must have been quite strange. You were the cinematic matchmaker, really. It wouldn't have happened without
so.
You.
I think so. My mother suspected it. She told me, I think. So I said, okay. You know, they have a way. They have a way of knowing. I'm always the last to know.
So I not only have the best job in the world, but I have the best husband in the world, thanks to Martin Scorsese.
And after you were married in 1984, did it change the relationship with Scorsese at all? Because you were now living and married to his great hero.
Well, I think he missed not having Michael around him as much as before, because he loved it. But he loved having Michael on the set with us, and Michael actually gave us some very good things. For example, Marty could not get Goodfellas sold because of the drugs. The studios kept saying, you have to take the drugs out of Goodfellas. And he said, I can't take the drugs out of Goodfellas. That's the story.
Yeah, it's totally
so sensitive. When I told Michael that, he got very upset. He was so passionately involved in Marty's artistic freedom. So he said, read me the script. His eyesight was going a bit. So I read him the script, and he said, get Marty on the phone. And I did. And he said, Marty, this is the best script I've read in 20 years. You have to make this movie. So Marty went in one more time and sold it. But Michael didn't live to see it, unfortunately.
But Scorsese he was galvanized
made.
By...
He knew if Michael Powell was telling him this is the best script I've read in 20 years, he better listen and try harder. I mean, everybody loves Goodfellas, right? Everybody says, I'm going to just watch 20 minutes of it, and they end up watching the whole thing. So can you imagine if that movie had not been made?
Incredible.
It's unthinkable.
So Scorsese benefited from Michael Powell's advice. Did you seek his advice?
You know, we didn't talk about editing much, because Michael claimed that he didn't go into the editing room, which is not quite true. I think Emmerich Pressburger did more.
Mm.
But the reason is that they only did one take. This is, I as an editor, it just stuns me.
Wow.
When you look at those movies, one take. Now, they rehearsed a lot, but Michael really felt that he only wanted to do one. So that is not such a big deal for an editor when you have a beautiful... Roger Livesey and Wendy Hiller, one take, and you cut them together. You still have to worry about motion and a mood and character building and length. But it doesn't take as much time as having Marty in the room looking at four different of his preferred takes that I've put together and for him to choose. So, but Michael could never understand. So we didn't talk much about editing, but he loved Scorsese's movies. He wanted to see where one of the scenes in Mean Streets had been filmed, a cemetery scene that he really liked. And De Niro was with Marty, and they took him to see that. And then they went to see De Niro training for Raging Bull. They were watching videotapes in his gym, and Marty was designing the shots in his head. And Michael said, there's something wrong about the red gloves. And Marty said, you're right. It should be in black and white. I saw these movies with my father, these fights, which were done in black and white, very cheap things in movie theaters. And he said, that's what it should be. And that was an enormous gift.
The irony is, of course, that Michael Powell's films were always saturated in color, and especially the color red.
Yes.
I mean, it's so significant, isn't it?
Michael said about Mean Streets, there's too much red. And Marty says, who gave me that idea? They're red in all these shots that Michael did.
And having been such a huge fan of Michael Powell yourself, and then married to him for 6 years, did it change your appreciation of the art of filmmaking, having seen everything almost through his eyes in that time?
I think, you know, Marty teaching me about the films of Powell and Pressburger is what really did it. Mm. With Michael and me, it was this wonderful life, you know, and his vivacious way of approaching things and his optimism. And he was just so wonderful to live with, you know. It didn't change how I felt about their films. I've loved restoring them, particularly the Technicolor ones, which was just heaven to do. But it's funny, Michael and I didn't talk much about filmmaking.
Michael Powell died at the age of 84 in 1990. He must have been so proud of your achievements.
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, he loved being with us. Sometimes he would just come bringing a cake into a looping session with Ray Liotta or something, you know. He just loved being back in the film world again. One of the things that happened while Michael was living with me is he had begun writing his autobiography by hand, but his eyesight began to weaken, and so I gave him a little recorder, and he would record all day his writings. And then I would come home at night and transcribe it. And then on Sunday, which was our favorite day, because we would never get out of our bathrobes, we would get up and work on his book. And we would edit it together. And that was one of the happiest times we ever had.
You are now in your 80s yourself,
yes.
Thelma, and still working, and I'm sure still waiting for the next call from Scorsese to work on.
What studio would hire an 84-year-old film editor?
There will be more films with Scorsese.
I hope so.
Yeah. What drives you on creatively?
Well, being an editor is one of the most creative jobs you could ever have in the world. I think it's the best job in the world. You're constantly shaping and creating a work of art. It's just fabulous. You can't ask for anything. I've had it all. I've had it all in my life, thanks to Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. And what is the next Scorsese project?
We're not allowed to talk about it.
I suspected that would be the answer. Thelma Schoonmaker, thank you so much for sharing your cultural life with us.
Oh, it's been a joy. Thank you.
Well, I really hope you enjoyed my conversation with the great film editor, Thelma Schoonmaker. And in fact, we filmed that episode, and you'll be able to watch it on BBC Four and on BBC iPlayer as part of a forthcoming Powell and Pressburger season of films and documentaries in November. Thelma was my last guest in the current series of This Cultural Life, in which we've heard from Nile Rodgers, Lee Child, Marina Abramovich, Kirita Kanawa, Hanif Qureshi, and many more. They join over 100 other leading creative figures who have shared their most important influences and inspirations, and who have told some extraordinary stories on this show. If you don't already, then please do subscribe to the series on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts internationally. That way, you never miss an episode. We'll be back at the very start of 2025 with more of the world's greatest artists. So until then, from series producer Edwina Pittman and me, John Wilson, thank you very much indeed for listening to This Cultural Life.
I'm Hannah Fry.
And I'm Dara O'Brien.
And in the all-new series of Curious Cases, things are getting curiouser and curiouser.
We'll be looking the universe squarely in the eye and demanding an answer to your everyday mysteries.
Including...
can you actually die of boredom?
Why do some people taste music?
And how many lemons would it take to power a spaceship?
We will shine a light on the world's most captivating oddities.
Brought to us by you, you delightful bunch of weirdos.
I don't think you're allowed to call them that.
But I love them, really.
Curious Cases. On Radio 4.
And available now on BBC Sounds.